From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. The magazine Cooks Illustrated has been guiding the home cook to reliable results for years, long before the advent of cooking blogs and food TV.
I'm okay with any appliance if it helps people cook better in the kitchen and get cooking.
That's Julia Cullen Davison talking with me about the wonders of the Instant Pot. You know her as the host of America's Test Kitchen. Among other things, we've been talking about Cooks Illustrated, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for having me.
I'm one of those people that remembers the original little, almost like zines, the little cooks books.
Oh, yeah.
That were originally associated with Cuisinart, I think.
Yeah, the how-tos.
Yeah, they were great. It's been so fascinating to just watch the development over the years.
Yeah, the company has grown so much, especially even in the past 5 years. We have hundreds of employees. Our kitchen went from 2,500 square feet to 15,000 last year when we moved down to the Seaport District in Boston. So we have full-time TV sets. We can be filming and cooking all day long to our heart's content. So it's gotten big.
It's a juggernaut.
It's a good word for it.
What makes a good recipe great and reliable and still have a palate that will make it delicious?
Yeah, it's a good question. In terms of America's Test Kitchen and Cooks Illustrated, the recipe has to be able to be done well by home cooks. You know, because in the test kitchen, right, 15,000 square feet, you know, all clad and stacked to the ceilings. We have full-time people shopping. We have 3 full-time kitchen assistants that help do the dishes and clean up. We can make anything work, right? But that's not a good recipe if we can make it work. It's only good if someone at home can make it work as well as we do. What I think the coolest part of our recipe development process is after we spend the time developing the recipe, and that process is neat on its own, we send the recipe out to our readers and viewers who've signed up to be recipe testers. And this is before it's published. And we send it to them. They make it in there across the country in their home kitchens. And they tell us if it worked. Could they find the ingredients? Could they have used a photo somewhere along the way to help them understand what the instructions meant and so on? And they fill out a survey and they send it back to us. So we have results right away as to whether people at home can make this recipe. And there's a question on every survey that asks, would you make the recipe again? And every recipe gets sent out, and every recipe must get an 80% yes, I would make this again before it gets published. And if it falls under that, we go back into the kitchen with all the comments of things that didn't work for people, and we do this anyway, and we fix it and we send it out again. So it's because a recipe works for people at home that I think makes the difference between a good recipe and a bad recipe. And you mentioned, you know, people have different flavors. Some people like things spicy. Some people like things less salty. But those are things that are easily tweaked by a home cook.
This idea that you have these home testers is just insane and amazing to me. How many are there?
Thousands.
Wow.
We have so many. We have different panels. I think we have maybe 12 or 15 panels, and each panel is a couple thousand. And anyone can sign up. It's free on our website. Be a friend of cooks. Be a recipe tester. We now have ATK Kids, which is we've taken this approach to developing recipes for kids to be able to cook. So we brought kids into the test kitchen. We watched them cook and understood how to rearrange a recipe, how to phrase things so that kids could make it. We realized you have to tell them to wash their hands. You have to tell them to turn the stove off as well as turn it on. And we have kid recipe testers across the country that we send these kid recipes out to, and they do the same thing. And we have a couple thousands of those kids, too. So it's an integral part of what we do.
For this latest book, with decades of recipes to cull through, what was the process of getting it down to 180 revolutionary recipes?
So it involved a lot of bickering over the editorial table, right? There were a lot to choose from. So we all kind of sat around and talked about what ones that we like to cook at home and which ones had something that really taught us something new. You know, whether it was cooking pasta in the sauce, whether it was not boiling corn, but poaching it so that you get the perfect cooked corn a cob every time. It took a while to pare the list down. All these recipes have great stories. And so you can hear the voices of the test cook who developed the recipe. And that's the other unique thing about the magazine. A test cook is assigned a recipe early on, say, corn on the cob. And they're responsible for shepherding that recipe through the entire development process and responsible for writing the story at the end of everything that they tried, what worked and what didn't, and how we finally landed where we landed. So all those stories are in the book, and they're just fun because the people that work in the test kitchen that are okay cooking corn on the cob for 6 weeks straight, they're characters, total characters, right? And so you get to know these characters that are just crazy about getting down to the bottom of the best food.
I'm actually surprised that any of you cook at home that you don't just order in by the time yes. you leave that place.
By cook, I mean open a bottle of wine. We do eat a lot. I mean, between Cook's Illustrated, Cook's Country, and our book department, and we put out a lot of cookbooks a year, and many of them are new recipes. We produce anywhere from 1,000 to 1,200 recipes a year. And, you know, I eat all of them. So I am.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to go back, what's the relationship of Cook's Illustrated to America's Test Kitchen, for those who don't know?
Yeah, so America's Test Kitchen is the television show on public television. We're about to start filming our 20th season, and all the recipes that are on America's Test Kitchen have been in Cook's Illustrated. So America's Test Kitchen is sort of the umbrella brand, and Cook's Illustrated is underneath that.
So sometimes it's the simplest things that are the most difficult to nail, starting with breakfast. So
yes.
Give us some tips for foolproof scrambled eggs.
Oh, you're putting me on the spot. So the thing about eggs is you have the whites, which are very lean and high in protein, and you have the yolks, which are very rich and full of fat. And, you know, when you think something tastes eggy, it's actually the whites that taste eggy, not the yolks. So it's not what most people think. And the best eggs, you take out a few of the whites, or rather you add an extra yolk or two. It just gives it a little more richness, a little bit more oomph. But save the whites and do something with them later, like a meringue. And then it's testing that sort of thing over and over. And then what heat do you use? You know, do you use moderate heat? Do you want big curds? Do you want little curds? Imagine each one of these questions as an argument around an editorial table about the benefits of what everyone likes and what we think everyone will like.
One of the things I like about this particular issue is you get into the size of the vessel, which I notice that when I teach classes is the thing that I'm telling people over and over and over again, like the size of your pan matters.
Yeah, they're not interchangeable. You know, this is something we find on those surveys that we send out. We ask people, you know, did you swap in something else? So we sent this recipe out for braised chicken, right? And most people liked it, but this one person wrote in, they hated the recipe. Oh, it was dry. It was the worst thing they ever cooked. But they substituted shrimp for the chicken. And so, right? And so they had poached shrimp for like 40 minutes instead of chicken thighs. And was like, oh, yeah, you can't do that. Most people don't do that.
People are fascinating, really.
Yeah. But pan size, you think, oh, what's the difference between a 10 and a 12-inch? Well, you know, it's a couple inches. And that couple inches can have a big effect on something that cooks really quickly because it's a lot more surface area. The difference between a nonstick and a traditional pan is also something we run into a lot because people like their nonstick pans. And I don't blame them. They're easy to clean. They're lightweight, and sometimes they're great, like for eggs. But sometimes you really need, if you want a really good sear and you want some fond to make a sauce, you can't use a nonstick pan because all the fond will stick to the food, not to the pan, and you want it to stick to the pan.
So now that we're talking about the size of vessels, one thing that could be good in a larger pan are mussels. Why don't people cook mussels at home more often?
I don't know. I think people are scared they're going to be bad. And most mussels, you know, are farm-raised. They're already clean. You know, we have all these illustrations on how to clean the little beard out of the side of a mussel. But I haven't seen a bearded mussel in ages, I got to say. And it's pretty easy to tell if they're bad. I mean, you'll smell them, and they won't open when you cook.
And I also think that people don't believe that it's as easy as it is.
It's true.
Like 2 minutes, you're done.
Yes, exactly. It's got to be harder than that. If you want to cook a small amount of mussels, doing it in a big pot on the stove, totally great. If you want to do it for four or more people, do it in the oven. You get them all open. You have a little bit more leeway not to overcook them or what have you. And you have more surface area.
Well, I've never done that before.
It's kind of a game changer, I have to say.
So let's talk for a minute about buttermilk, this marvelous dairy acid. What is it about buttermilk that makes it a staple for frying chicken?
It's all about the buttermilk brine, right? Acidity, and then you load in a bunch of salt, and you let the chicken sit in that. and almost marinate, but it's not quite a marinade because the acid isn't doing as much as the salt. You take some of that buttermilk and you put it in the flour. And you know how when you're done breading chicken, the breading looks all kind of clumpy? And then you realize those last few pieces were the best pieces you made because the clumps fried? We pretty much do that on purpose. But back to buttermilk, it's just sort of that essential flavor, that rich, sour, dairy flavor that goes with biscuits and fried chicken. Boy, I'm getting hungry now.
So let's move on to grains. Do you find that people are less afraid of all the different grains that are available to them these days?
Yeah. Things like farro are getting some good play. Quinoa, that was the grain of the year, 2 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
If there was a grain of the year. Yeah, Miss Quinoa, 2016. And then there's amaranth and millet. Along in our process, not only do we test recipes after they're developed, we poll all of our readers ahead of time to figure out what they want to know about, what's on their radar. And so grains has been hitting home for a lot of people. I think it's the rise of the Mediterranean diet, and it's kind of anti-paleo, but a lot of people who are into the whole grains, the whole idea of being vegan or vegan before six or vegan on the weekdays, or that being vegan once or twice a week even to just help reset and strip some of the dairy and bread out is another reason why grains are becoming more popular.
What do you guys think about Instapots?
I am personally pro multi-cookers. Now, Instapot's a brand, right? And we did a testing of them, and Instapot didn't win. The pressure cooker function on it did really well. The slow cooker function, well, it was a little dicey. I believe the winning brand was Fagor, F-A-G-O-R. I'm a huge pressure cooker fan. I think it makes the best chicken broth in the world.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
Are you? Yeah, and so I've had a stovetop one forever. I got, you know, this multi-cooker one, and it was a game changer for me in that I could walk away, you know, not stand by, monitor the temperature, and it worked just as well. Now, the inserts are all nonstick, so, you know, there's a little bit. I always worry about that a little bit, but I have to say the ease of it is pretty cool. I do demos around the country at different PBS stations and so on. One of the demos, I cook salmon under pressure for 5 minutes, and it comes out perfect every time, and people like it because it seems easy. It doesn't smell. And so I think I'm okay with any appliance if it helps people cook better in the kitchen and get cooking. Personally, I'm not a gadget person too much. I like a good blender. I'm kind of into the Instapot, but that's just for broth, really. Most of the braises I still do in the oven because I have the time. But if you didn't have the time, yeah, I think they're great. It's a good, solid tool.
Let's end our conversation with dessert.
Okay.
What is the pudding method for making an old-fashioned chocolate layer cake?
Oh, that is such an interesting method because you make the batter on the stovetop. So, and it's kind of an old-fashioned way. You make pudding, and then you mix all the dry ingredients right in the saucepan. And it's just a different mixing method. Instead of creaming butter and sugar, you're making a pudding and adding the flour, which kind of is in the vein of making a bouilli before you make a classic souffle. So it's in that style in a way, and it just makes it really moist. I mean, it's best for chocolate cake because a substantial portion of the flour will be taken up with cocoa powder, which won't make gluten, because when you do this, you are creating quite a lot of gluten. It's kind of a great way to make an old-fashioned cake. It's just very moist, but not too delicate. It has a little more heft to it, which is my kind of cake. I'm not a big fan of delicate cakes.
We don't hear very much about the food scene in Boston out here.
Yeah, you don't, huh? What is the food scene in Boston?
Is there? I shouldn't ask. I'm sure there's a food scene in Boston.
You know, it's seafood, not surprisingly, which never grows old with me. Now, ramen seems to be taking over the world at this point.
Oh, yes, that's true.
All the sushi places have turned into ramen places at Boston, but that's almost passé at this point. What I'm liking is that foods that are homey, like ramen, are really getting a firm grip into sort of people's everyday lives. My 10-year-old begs for ramen, and not the styrofoam cup stuff, but the real stuff. And it's now part of how she's growing up. And that, to me, is really cool. The one thing they do not have in Boston is great Mexican food. It is horrible. I went to, when I first moved there, and I moved from California, I was living in San Francisco, went to get a burrito, and they put... What did they put in that? I think they put zucchini and mushrooms. And I was like, what? What are you doing? And it was roast chicken with zucchini and mushrooms. I thought, oh, man, like, it was fine. But
That's not a wrap. Not a burrito.
That's not a burrito, you know?
I can't wait to hear the mail we get from this question.
Oh, no.
Thank you so much, Julia.
Thank you for having me. Nice talking to you.
That's Julia Collin-Davison, host of America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country. We've been discussing the 25th anniversary of Cook's Illustrated and how it changed American home cooking. Now we turn to the ongoing federal government shutdown, the longest in U.S. history. How does it impact what's on our plates? In a moment, some answers from Mother Jones writer Tom Philpott. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. The current federal government shutdown is now officially the longest in U.S. history, and shockwaves are being felt throughout the country, from banks to airports. But how does it affect what we eat? Tom Philpott recently reported for Mother Jones on the shutdown's impact on our food system. Hi there.
Hi, Evan.
So, you know, as soon as this happened, I started to wonder, there's been such an erosion of regulation and inspection sort of throughout different government agencies, including the USDA. Is the fact that the government is shut down making a substantial difference in the danger for us to eat certain foods?
I don't know how immediately substantial it is. I mean, so, you know, for one thing, the USDA is maintaining its staff of inspectors who inspect meat facilities. And I think there's a lot of problems with that system, but the shutdown hasn't affected it. So, those guys are still on the job, as far as I know, still getting paid. What it has affected is the FDA. So the FDA is the agency, the Food and Drug Administration, that inspects all the rest of the food. It's sort of responsible for everything that's not meat. And a bunch of their inspectors are furloughed. Now, just this past week, the FDA director, Scott Gottlieb, he did mention that the sort of high-risk foods, stuff like soft cheeses and dairy products and fresh fruits and vegetables, inspectors for those products are coming back online. There's about 150 of them who are furloughed. They're coming back online without pay, but they are going to be inspecting these high-risk facilities, which I think is good news. I mean, I think we want those people on the job. You know, the fact that it's just 150 for the entire nation doesn't inspire a lot of confidence. A lot of people think we should have more inspectors in the job, but they are back on the job. But I think we should also think about the routine inspections for the quote-unquote non-high-risk foods. Those inspectors are furloughed, and we have seen food safety disasters come out of foods that aren't considered high risk. The best example that I've seen recently is that there's a massive peanut butter recall back in 2009. And we don't think about peanut butter as being this sort of high risk thing. It isn't like a raw milk cheese or a steak or something like that that could contain pathogens. But in 2009, there was a really, really big recall and a salmonella outbreak that actually sickened more than 700 people and killed 9 people. And, you know, when journalists like me back at the time looked back at it, there was a lack of routine inspection. And what routine inspections did happen from the one company that was responsible for it showed all kinds of problems in the company, like rat infestations and leaks that were letting rain in from the roof and putting mold on equipment that likely led to the outbreak. And so when, you know, sort of non-risky foods are going uninspected, we should worry about it for sure.
Yeah, that was horrifying. We don't want to see another one of those.
No.
I've been reading that people are suggesting that all of us eat like pregnant women.
I think that's probably not bad advice. And I think for pregnant women, they should definitely eat, you know, be even more careful at this time. Yeah, so there's this this very famous food safety attorney up in Seattle named Bill Marler, does a lot of food safety cases. He gave a list of foods that he's going to be more careful about, and he mentioned leafy greens and sprouts and stuff like cheese and ice cream. And, you know, he says, if you're a pregnant woman or a child, people with compromised immune systems, you should definitely stay away from that kind of stuff completely. I don't know if I'd go that far, but I do think people need to take extra precautions.
So many farmers, obviously, were supporters of Trump in 2016. Is the halt in government resources causing any negative ripples among his agricultural constituents that you know about?
It definitely is. There's a couple of things that are affecting them on this. One of them is that the USDA puts out these reports pretty regularly that talk about the condition of corn and soybean stocks, like how much are left over from the past year, how harvests are doing in places like Argentina and Brazil. And they give a lot of transparency to the market. And so if you're a farmer right now and you're thinking about planting seeds for next year, you know, buying seeds, planting fields for next year, you rely on these reports to figure out how much to plant. And these reports are just stopped at a very, very key time. And that also affects investors who invest in stuff like corn and soybean futures. So they also rely on this kind of thing. And the more information they have, the sort of smoother the market is. There are less surprises. And so what you can see from that angle is, you know, choppier, more volatile markets for these things isn't good for farmers. And also a lack of transparency as they try to prepare for the next season. And then the other big thing is that because of another Trump machination, these trade wars that he's involved us in, you know, they've seen huge tariffs on their goods in markets like China, and that's caused massive, you know, multi-billion dollar losses to them. And so Trump last year rolled out this sort of what's been called a tariff bailout for farmers. And because the USDA office that administers it is closed, if you're a farmer and you haven't registered your losses yet, because a lot of them had late harvests and they couldn't register them before the shutdown happened, then your bailout money is on hold. That's definitely causing consternation in farm country.
Now, what about low-income households? Have they been affected yet by the shutdown or the president's earlier proposed cuts of government assistance programs?
They have not yet. So there's two big programs in question. There's the SNAP program that's, you know, basically food stamps for low-income Americans. And there's a women, infants, and children program that's specifically for new mothers. And both of those programs are funded through February. So they basically, you know, found money from other parts of the budget and use it as a stopgap. And so those checks will keep coming through February. After that, it's pretty unclear what's going to happen. And one thing that we do know is that the administration has been hostile to these anti-poverty, anti-hunger programs basically since they came into office. There's been, you know, lots of attempts to cut them that haven't worked. And I think it's making people pretty uneasy that this administration is responsible for finding money for them if the shutdown continues. And there isn't a lot of confidence that it'll keep coming after February.
So to talk about a different subject that affects a different part of our society, I was surprised to learn of the adverse effects of a closed government on craft brewers. It's such an odd niche situation. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, and you know, it doesn't just affect craft brewers. It also affects the wine industry. And so what this is if you're a maker of alcoholic beverages, you come up with a label for your product. And every one of those labels, every label on the shelf, no matter how big or small the brewer or winemaker is, has to get approved by a government office in the federal government. And it's a pretty straightforward and, you know, almost perfunctory task. There are certain things that have to be in the label. Alcohol level, you know, a warning sign about pregnant women consuming alcohol and things like that. And someone literally looks for that stuff, checks it off, and approves the label. But with the government office that does this now shut down, the process is completely stopped. And, you know, the point I made in my article is that if you're an enormous brewer that makes Budweiser, and that's your bread and butter product, and you've got three or four products like that, Bud Light or Michelob or whatever, it's not going to affect you that much. Your label is already approved. But a lot of these small brewers, their whole business model is about coming out with new products, seasonal products, you know, new styles of beer, sour beers, IPAs, and things like that. And those brewers are completely hamstrung by this. And I think that it, you know, as it grinds on, we'll start to hear winemakers complain about it too. They want to put their new vintage out, or they've got a new blend that they want to put out. And this, what is usually this sort of routine task of getting the government to approve the label, is now on hold. And, you know, when the government reopens, they're going to have a huge backlog. And so it's going to take a lot of time to get labels out. So I think this is a story that I think we're going to be hearing a lot about in the coming months.
Well, thank you so much, Tom.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That's Tom Philpott. Find a link to his article for Mother Jones on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Now for a different kind of shutdown in the nation's second largest school district, right here in L.A. On Monday, nearly 34,000 teachers in the L.A. Unified School District walked off the job, striking for smaller class sizes, more resources, and better pay. It's the first teacher strike in L.A. in 30 years. 80% of the students in LAUSD schools qualify for free or reduced school meal programs. They rely on school for their daily nutrition. Around the county, groups are stepping up to feed students and teachers during the strike.
A police officer loaned us a RV for free. He did not even know me. So we can have a place to prepare the food for the students and a place to rest.
Pamela Sanders is coordinating one such effort at 9th Street Elementary School near downtown. Hi, Pamela.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm good. What is your job on a normal day?
On a normal day, I'm a teacher at 9th Street Elementary as a preschool special ed teacher. I work with little ones from the ages of 3 to 5 years old.
Wow. Tell me what's happening at 9th Street Elementary. Is it open with a skeleton crew or have classes been canceled altogether?
The school is open. It is a skeleton crew. All teachers at my school site, 9th Street Elementary, 100% decided to strike. So no teachers from the school are there. We see a few substitutes here and there going in, but a lot less.
And what about students attending? Are most students staying home?
So most students are staying home. In my class alone, I had one student to attend on one day and then two students attend today. It's still very, very small, not normal.
I understand that about 49 of the students at your school live in a shelter and they're required to go to school in order to stay at the shelter.
That is correct. We have 49 students that do stay in a shelter, some stay in motels, but for sure the ones that stay in a shelter, if they want to stay in a shelter now or even in the future, they must go to school, whether the teachers are on strike or not.
So tell me, given that for a lot of these kids, school is where they really get to eat food every single day, what is happening with the kids who aren't coming? Is somebody organizing food that can be picked up by parents?
Yes. So at our school, and actually out of our teachers' union, there are 100 schools that are providing a food drive. And I'm one of the sites that's having a food drive, meaning we got donations to give to those students that are not attending school due to the strike, and we can hand out lunches for free to them. We got donations from Whole Foods. They donated $500 in gift cards. We got donations from Superior Market. They gave us a $50 gift card.
Are you giving gift cards directly to parents, or are you using the money to, like, make bag lunches and then pass out the lunches?
You're right. So basically, we take the gift cards to Whole Foods, and then they actually are preparing the lunches for us. So on Monday, we went in, and they already had pre-made lunches for the students. They had a piece of fruit, a juice box, a breakfast bar, also a smoothie or yogurt. And on top of that, we have lunch meat and bread to make sandwiches. And then we've got some Lunchables because we were able to get $300 from UTLA that donated to our cause as well. So each school, there are 100 schools, like I said, out of 900 schools in the district that only has this program. And so, again, we're one of them.
And how well is it working? Are parents aware that they can come pick up this food?
We held actually a meeting before the strike to the parents to let them know that we will be providing food if the students get at home. And the teachers, all the teachers here, we message our parents, letting them know we have the food here for them. We gave them certain times. But unfortunately, we have not been having a lot of people show up for the food. We had some parents that walk with us on the picket line, and then when they finished, we gave them the food to give to their students. But other than that, we haven't had big show of people coming to get the food. So we like to get the word out that we have plenty of food to give out here. We don't want it to go to waste.
Do you think the weather is having an impact?
I think that's it. I'm hoping that's all it is. And maybe we'll have more people coming when the weather dies down.
Tell me a bit about the school, where it is, and what kind of families and students you have.
Yes, so we're located in downtown LA, right near the Garment District, near the some of the missions and the shelters. And so it's not really a residential area, it's more of an industrial area. So the students that we serve are, again, really needy because they're in the shelters, some of them. Other students may come because their parents work in the area and they may get permits to come to our school. And others may be just coming to the school, but they may not live as close.
How can a student find out if a school in their area is distributing meals?
Actually, what they can do, they can go to the UTLA website, and there should be a contact number for our union, and they can direct them to where they can go. Call UTLA.net.
Thank you so much, Pamela. I really appreciate you taking time off the line to talk with us.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
I've been talking to Pamela Sanders of 9th Street Elementary. She's been telling me about efforts to distribute food to students during the LAUSD strike. If you listened to our show last week, you were introduced to the two new food critics who were handpicked by the LA Times to succeed Jonathan Gold. After the break, Bill Addison joins us with his first review. Stay with us. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman. Now for a visit with LA Times food critic Bill Addison. He's here to talk about the first restaurant that he reviewed for the paper. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan.
So what is your first review?
My first review is Fiona. It's Nicole Rucker's bakery and restaurant on Fairfax Avenue.
Nicole with?
Sean Pham.
Sean Pham, formerly of Symbol.
Yes, in Little Tokyo.
It's an interesting collaboration.
I think if they had a term for what they're doing at Fiona, they'd call it Los Angeles comfort food.
Yeah, and what I find really interesting is they're now on a strip that has so many places. They're like across the street from John and Vinny's. They're a couple doors down from Cantor's.
And Diamond Bakery. Yes.
So it's kind of a daunting area in which to like throw down your spear, so to speak.
It's brave.
Yeah.
But Rucker has pie on her side.
And really great bread.
And really great bread, yeah. The thing to know immediately about this restaurant is how great the baking program is. I think everyone refers to her as the Pie Queen of Los Angeles. I don't know whether she loves that title or not, but she's got the magic touch. I mean, she won 4 ribbons at the annual pie contest for KCRW, right?
Yeah. What I love is when I go to a place and I see the pies in the morning and they're already almost gone.
Yes. Pie for breakfast is my favorite thing. I mean, I really love pie. There were several reasons why this felt like a good place to jump into restaurant criticism for the Los Angeles Times, but pie is maybe my favorite thing on the planet, so I just wanted to write about what I love.
Any other highlights of the bakery case you want to talk about?
We should talk about the fact that it's winter and what that means for pies, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I'm so excited. Nicole Rucker has a book coming out later this year called Dappled, which is all about fruit and fruit desserts. So I'm already daydreaming about when the strawberry pies show up and the peach pies and the plum pies and what she's going to do with blueberries and rhubarb and all that stuff. But winter right now, for me, is all about the key lime pie, which should basically be called the Mexican lime pie because it is the same fruit essentially at its origin. Of course, there are going to be different varietals, but this thing is some kind of feat of engineering, what she came up with. The filling is like dense and fudgy and like just hits you in all the right places. Her graham cracker crust is like, if you just take a smidgen of it on its own, it's pronounced in its saltiness. And then the whipped cream on top has sour cream in it. nothing about it is too sweet. I legit would eat that pie for breakfast with a cup of coffee and not feel out of balance.
But if you need the too sweet, she always has those buttermilk pies.
Yes, she does. Right. Which are great. I had one with cranberry when I first got here in December that was amazing. But there are also plenty of other good things to eat for breakfast, too. Sean Pham's Vietnamese beef stew, I think a lot of people are ordering that for breakfast. And I sort of love that as kind of the statement on what comfort food might be to start the day in Los Angeles right this moment.
Because what they're doing is something that many people have tried to do and not been able to sustain, which is all-day dining.
Yes. I mean, certainly that is the trend. I feel like this is the 2019 passing of the baton of République in some ways. It's a very different, much fancier, particularly at night. But Margarita Mansky's pastry program at République is exceptional. And Nicole Rucker's is much homier in its delivery, but no less sublime.
So they opened right before Thanksgiving.
Yes.
So they could sell people pie. And they've been taking it very slowly, in particular the savory side. They've been adding things slowly, slowly. But I think one of the things that I had that blew my socks off from the savory side and the toast part of the menu, because I love that there's a toast part of the menu.
The bread is so good, too, right?
Was the
dahi? The dahi toast. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. It is a riff on a breakfast or a snack in Indian and Indian American households. And it's essentially just a yogurt sandwich in that context that Sean has taken into like a really crusty, thick piece of toast slathered with seasoned yogurt that's almost like raita. And then covered with these deep fried curry leaves seasoned with mustard leaves that are crackly and the textures are so good.
Yeah, love that.
Yep, same. And everything else, there's a dinner menu that carries over some of the things, the Vietnamese beef stew, some of these plate-sized pancakes that they've got going on, like sweet potato with umeboshi creme fraiche and lardon.
Did you have the celery pancakes, celery remoulade pancakes?
Yes, I feel like it's important to get the optional smoked trout with it, and it really makes that dish. Did you get it with the smoked fish? Yeah. She's nodding happily and soulfully.
What other highlights?
Yeah, there is a roast black cod dish with dill and turmeric that is something off the Symbol menu that I really loved. I feel like dinner is the part of the menu that's the most work in progress. But if you get the roasted cod, if you get the hamachi crudo with flavors of pineapple and lime in it, that's actually just simple and pure and wonderful. There's plenty of good stuff there, too.
And I have to say, I think it's one of the best baguettes in town.
Instantly, right? I mean, I feel like, Athena from the head of Zeus, the bakery program emerges fully formed. And everything else is sort of deliberately slow, fascinating, evolving work in progress.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Evan.
I've been talking with LA Times food critic Bill Addison about Fiona on Fairfax. Now we turn to another Bill. Some years back, we had Bill Esparza on our show as our regular taco correspondent. Many of you know Bill from his diligent coverage of Mexican food in LA over the years, and perhaps his book, LA Mexicano. I'm pleased to say he's back with us today to share a few of his recent finds. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Evan. How are you?
I'm great. So it seems that things are shifting a bit when it comes to Mexican food in LA.
Yeah, it's getting more interesting all the time, ever more hyper-regional.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So let's just jump in. Talk to me about Barbacush.
It's so interesting because, I've spent a lot of time traveling to Mexico, and I've never even heard of their style of menudo. In Puebla, they call menudo mole de panza, and it's regular menudo. But in the city of Tepeaca, they do it with lamb. I didn't find it in Mexico, but I found it in a backyard in East L.A.
I have to say, looking at the photographs that came with the spread that you did for Eater, what really hit me was the lamb head.
Yes. In that part of Mexico, the state of Mexico, Hidalgo, and Puebla, they do barbacoa and they have their various traditions. And lamb heads are one of the things you're going to find in all those regions. So Barbacush, you know, where they're from in the city of Tepeaca, they prepare regular barbacoa and also whole lamb heads, which are fun eating. You know, you get to tear the eyes and tongue and cheeks off of it and make little tacos. They have great quesadillas, but their lamb menudo, it is so flavorful. It's really the most tasty menudo I've ever had.
So aside from the fact that it's lamb innards instead of beef innards, which is what we would usually find in a bowl of menudo, I have to say that the sauce that is adding this punch to the broth looks extraordinary.
Yeah, so you have lamb liver in there and also tendon and the chitterlings. And so they're using, I think, chile guajillo, their local herbs and flavors from their region, but it just gets that richness from the actual liver of the lamb, I believe, you know? It's got a darker color than your typical menudo.
Okay, so who's making the food?
Petra Zavaleta, she is the barbacoa master, and she learned from her father. You know, one of the days I was there, her parents were actually visiting her father who had shown her how to do this. So she grew up doing this in Puebla and had been doing it in her backyard, and her kids are kind of in on the business too, and they decided to call it Kush because they wanted to say, well, you know, that their menudo is the best, and since Kush is the best weed, they got the best barbacoa to, you know, appeal to a younger audience, because a lot of times Mexicans, either born in the U.S. or the second, third generation, don't have connection to those traditions, so this was an idea to attract the young people as well as the old.
They also serve a consomme with garbanzo beans that looks delicious.
Yeah, the consomme varies from region to region, but theirs has a lot of stuff in it, so it's really like a soup.
Now, this is one of those examples of a business that started in somebody's garage. They got a ton of coverage, and they immediately disappeared, and now they have reappeared with a truck, right?
Yes. You know, because of the kids, they were doing pop-ups, so they were going to coffee shops and bars. Yeah, they're all over town right now, and they're also back in their original location.
Okay, so let's go from barbacush to Antojitos Los Cuates.
Okay. Antojitos Los Cuates, they're coming from Ciudad Guzman, Jalisco, and we have not seen anything like that here in Los Angeles, especially not in a food truck. But this guy is doing really artisanal cooking of the antojitos that you find at night in the cenadurías. Cenadurías in Mexico are the supper houses. And, you know, traditionally in Mexico, you have a light breakfast, a really heavy meal in the midday. We don't call it lunch. We call it the meal, la comida. And then at night, you have la cena, which is supposed to be like pozole. And it varies from region to region, of course. But this beautiful cooking that this guy's doing, he's bringing in these really exceptional tostadas from his hometown. They're called raspadas. He's bringing cheese from there. So he's bringing all the little things that really tie together the dishes, like the tostadas. And he's making pozole with pork spine. This is really the only place you can go on a regular basis to get truly Mexican artisanal pozole.
So I'm really curious about these tostadas raspadas, the texture. Could you like describe how it's different from a regular tostada bottom that we might experience?
Yeah, the raspadas are coarse. And so you get this texture, but they're also, it's really the flavor. It's not so much, I mean, a lot of tostadas you have around town are commercial and they don't have a lot of great flavor in them. They just have that crunchiness. But these, they're thicker, but they're just huge, huge corn flavor.
So when I think of antojitos, I think of sort of a symphony on the theme of masa.
Yeah. Most of the antojitos that we love are made of masa. But antojitos are these little cravings. Tacos are antojitos. All these things, enchiladas, tostadas, what we also call vitamina T, vitamin T in Mexico, all the things that start with T. Tamales, tortas, tacos, tostadas. Yes, many of them are these masa shapes.
What is the meat that's on top of the tostadas raspadas?
In Jalisco, they are, you know, pickled pig's feet, pig skin, and los cuates, they're doing it, home picklings of pork and skin, and then cured pork loin.
Wow, that sounds so fantastic.
So you got to get the mixta, and it's a big tostada. I mean, this is a tostada you can share with people. The flavor is so amazing, you know. We don't have people doing that kind of craft.
And where can we find this truck?
They are located in Compton, which is just always a great place for Mexican food. I think some of our best vendors these days are in Compton, and they're in the, you know, the parking lot of a donut shop.
Next, let's move to the Tijuana taco trend. So who are the people doing it well? I've heard about Tacos 1986.
Yeah.
But then they also lost their space. Let's talk about them for a minute.
Yeah. Well, the originals here in Los Angeles are what we call the Tire Shop Taqueria and Los Poblanos and A Carbon. Now, the thing about this particular style of Tijuana tacos, carne asada, is all the taqueros in Tijuana, and it's really Baja. You find it all over Baja California and even in Baja California Sur, but they are taqueros from the city of Izúcar de Matamoros, Puebla. They come to Baja to do Tijuana-style tacos. So every one of them, they're called poblanos, los poblanitos, el poblano. So they're Pueblans that are doing Tijuana-style carne asada. And that's what the tire shop is, and that's what Los Poblanos is. 1986, they are the new kids on the block in terms of the Tijuana style. They're coming from that cross-border culture of growing up in Tijuana and also in San Diego, kind of like Chef Javier Plasencia and many of the chefs that are really and vendors that are popular right now in Tijuana. They have that cross-cultural life. The guys at 1986, they grew up having those tacos and having that food. So they do a Rosarito-style taco, which is a flour tortilla with carne asada, beans, and lots of vegetables. They do such a great version of that. And they're bringing not just Tijuana style, but the whole Baja culture to the streets of Los Angeles.
Do you have intel about where Tacos 1986 is right now?
Yeah, they were in Hollywood, and they just moved to Koreatown.
Well, that's great for me. Thank you so much, Bill. This has been really fun. I look forward to having you back.
Thank you, Evan. It's always fun talking tacos with you.
That's Bill Esparza, author of El Mexicano. He's been giving me a rundown of some of his recent finds around the city. After the break, our first market report of the year with Laura Avery. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Now over to Santa Monica Farmers Market, where Laura Avery is doing her first report for us as a recent retiree.
This is Laura Avery with a market report. The recent rains have caused some very interesting things to pop up on farm country across California. And I'm here talking today, so happy to be standing here with executive chef Michele Lisi from Nerano Restaurant. It's located on Little Santa Monica Boulevard. Tell us a little bit about the cuisine that you cook there, chef, and then what are you looking for today?
Yeah, so hi, this is Michele Lisi. Basically, my kind of cuisine is mostly Southern Italian food. I use all the ingredients, you know, by season. I love mushroom right now, so the chanterelle is one of my favorite. The chanterelle, I like because like the color. Sometimes a vegetable, they look like some other fruit. Like, you know, if you taste like a mushroom, chanterelle, it's almost like you're having an apricot, a peach kind of flavor. So I love to use herbs with the chanterelle. So sometimes you can just saute with a little bit of olive oil with a clove of garlic or some shallots. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, you add some chives, like the French, or you put some rosemary or thyme. It's really good flavor with the, you know, chanterelles. I love to use it that way.
I just think butter. When I see a chanterelle, I just say, well, butter.
Yeah. Parmesan cheese also.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, so good. How are you preparing the chanterelles at Nerano?
The dish that I do there is a gnudi, which is a typical dish from Tuscany, actually. It's a ricotta, spinach, and flour and eggs, shape of a gnocchi. It's kind of fluffier than a gnocchi, so it doesn't have potato. And what I do is I toast the sage with some brown butter. I saute the chanterelle, which, you know, you have to clean before with a brush, something, and then you cut it small pieces. And then I cook the gnudi, I add them to the sauce with a little water. And then I finish with some black truffle on top, which is a good combination, perfect for the winter and spring.
Where do you get the black truffles?
Black truffle I'm getting from Italy. Right now, the season start of the black winter truffle. Really one of my favorite. Mm-hmm. Sometimes better than the white because flavor, it's really good. It's black inside, so it has a nice color, very earthy. And with this dish, with the nudie, it's amazing.
And you're just shaving a few on top, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, a little bit. I can't imagine how much one truffle from Italy must cost. Can you tell us?
Well, depends which one. The whites right now are, you know, from... actually, it's a good season because it rained a lot. So they don't go over $2,000 a pound. Each is a good season. The black one, the Perigord, which is the black winter truffle, around $700 a pound, which is more, you know. Mm-hmm. You can buy a black winter truffle, a medium size, for like $50. Mm-hmm. So you can do some good dishes out of it.
You can shave it on at least five dishes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us, sharing this dish. And so great to see you here at the market. And be sure to come when it rains because all kinds of stuff pops up. You never know.
It's true. I will. Thank you for asking.
Thank you, Chef. That was Executive Chef Michele Lisi from Nirano Restaurant, located on Little Santa Monica Boulevard, specializing in Southern Italian seasonal. Absolutely has whetted our taste buds to the max. As we were just talking with Chef Michele about mushrooms, chanterelles are wild mushrooms. They are not cultivated. They basically grow on open, untended land up in the national forests, and they're seasonal, and they only pop out when it rains. We have our wild mushroom guy here, David West from Clearwater Farm. He's been coming for years. He contracts directly with the pickers who get the national forest permits to go up and harvest not only the chanterelles, but the truffles and the... all those beautiful mushrooms, yeah. The porcinis, everything you bring in. So, David, you were just gave us some shocking news right now. Tell us what's happening with the pickers and their permits.
Well, right now is winter mushroom season, but more importantly is truffle season, which is 6 to 8 weeks a year at best, if we're lucky. And the truffle picker, who I've known for since 1995, so close to, you know, 25 years, mm-hmm. He called me on Sunday, which he normally does, to let me know how he's made out. And he said, you know, I can't get on and pick. Because they're not issuing, all the permits expired on 12/31. He went out with 5 years of prior permits to say, look, I always get a permit. And they said, we're not accepting expired permits. We will let you dump the truffles you've picked and leave without a fine. But if we see you here again, we'll cite you. It can be up to a $10,000 fine. It's Bureau of Land Management, which is under the Forest Service. Mm-hmm. Controls maybe 80% of the best picking land. Would they control 80% of really the forest in this nation? And they're not issuing any permits because the office is closed, but enforcement is done by state and county rangers. So the enforcement is out, but the permit issuers are not working. So we're sitting here with a table, an empty table, basically.
You would think that they would know each other because it seems like it's a very small group.
It is a small group, and it's in small areas where they probably do see each other at the local diner. Mm-hmm. But it's a very adversarial and always has been. The mushroom picking circuit, as they call it, is a very underground kind of scofflaw nation. Mm-hmm. And obviously, people that work in law enforcement, even if it's park rangers, don't appreciate that kind of activity.
So you mean you're saying that there are pickers up there who just don't bother to get permits, who are just up there just going rogue?
Yes and yes. Uh-huh. There are pickers that will work without permits. There are pickers who don't do a good job, who don't have respect. You know, about 15 years ago when the Matsutake mushroom price was very high in Japan, they had guys going with gas-powered leaf blowers to blow away all the duff. So it'd be easier to find the mushrooms, not realizing that then mushrooms won't grow for another 5 or 6 years. Mm. The only thing that stopped that was other mushroom pickers. Mm. But yes, there's a rogue element. It's a cash business in the middle of the night, in the middle of the woods, not something the government is really fond of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's the kind of the nature and the essence of the wild mushroom. It cannot be cultivated. You can't grow it down here, like in your backyard or by your swimming pool. You got to go up where the wild mushroom is. And you've got to, like you said, you've got to respect the growing ground and understand there needs to be mushrooms next year and the next year, too.
Well, yeah. I mean, the peach farmer doesn't cut off the branch to harvest the peaches. He gets up on a ladder. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, if you destroy the land, you're not going to get mushrooms. But mushroom pickers, self-police.
Yeah.
But they don't self-police permits and things like that. I've known my truffle guy since 1995. And
yeah.
He's limited to picking on private land that he can be granted access to. Just because it's not BLM land doesn't mean he can just go pick on it.
Mm-hmm.
He has to have an arrangement, and those arrangements are hard to come by. And then they have to be truffle land. Mm-hmm. All those things have to line up, and it's not lining up.
You talk about winter mushrooms. We are in winter in California. What other mushrooms are going to be coming up soon?
Yeah, well, it's again, same problem, mostly BLM land. We have hedgehogs, which is a really popular little orange mushroom. Got a nutty, wonderful, spicy almost flavor. Yellowfoot chanterelles, which is the winter version of the local chanterelle that you'll see now coming from San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara counties, which is a nice mushroom. It's the same variety as our little golden mushroom. It's a little bit muddier, because it takes a lot of rain to produce it down here. And we get black trumpets, which some people call the morels of the winter now. People are always inventing new marketing terms for things. But black trumpets have a rich, I always used to call them the demi-glace of the mushroom world. Very dark, rich, strong flavor. The vast majority of which grow on BLM land. Again, nobody can go out and pick. You will see some in the marketplace because some guys go out and pick. Other people get leases with timber lease companies, but there's a lot of wink and a nod going on. And with $10,000 fines, people are just scared.
That's David West. He is the mushroom guy. He's with Clearwater Farms. He's been coming to the markets here for over, what'd you say, decades? 92. Since 1992. You can find him at the Wednesday and Saturday downtown Santa Monica Farmers Markets every week. For The Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Many thanks to Laura Avery. She recently retired from the Santa Monica Farmers Market, but she's staying on as our correspondent for the next few months. That is it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, as always, you can listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, and as always, leave us a review if you liked the show. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Abby Swanson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.